then it is, in principle, quantum mechanical randomness. It's like observing, say, the ground state of a harmonic oscillator, where you observe a Gaussian random position. But the oscillator is actually in a pure state. And likewise, our universe, if our ideas about the early universe are correct, the universe is in some sort of quantum mechanical pure state. But as soon as we start to make observations, we collapse the wave function and we see some Gaussian-looking random pattern. And you can think of that as a classical random variable in one of two ways, I suppose. You could either think of it as randomizing over restarting the quantum mechanical processes, like restarting the initial randomness in the universe. Or you could imagine that you have a huge universe and you're randomizing over locations where you can observe it, averaging over Hubble volume-sized regions. I think either of those is a consistent way to think about it. That's right. As long as two observers in the universe, I suppose a little loophole here is that we don't know for sure that the universe is infinite. It could be a closed universe, but ignore that. Then two universes that are separated by more than a Hubble length, their observations will be uncorrelated and equivalent to looking at different random initial conditions.
Which is a big problem if there is a multiverse with different effective coupling constants, and we don't know how to do the probabilities over that.
Oh yeah, fair enough. Yeah. I suppose you get into foundational issues like the measure problem. whether you weight by proper volume or something else, like the probability of producing an observer. Kind of a ill-posed question. Okay. So today I want to talk about, I thought I would just introduce you to a very ubiquitous part of the observational cosmology toolkit, something called the Fisher matrix for forecasting. Empirically, according to my archive search, there are about 100 cosmology papers per year, which are mainly concerned with computing something called a Fisher matrix. So today I'm going to talk about what this is, and if you decide to do observational cosmology, then there's a high probability you'll write a Fisher matrix paper someday. I'm going to talk about what it is and why we're all so obsessed with it. So as a motivating example, you might wonder how you can forecast the parameter sensitivity of the CMB. Suppose you're thinking about a CMB experiment that hasn't been done yet, that's going to measure this power spectrum with some statistical errors. And we know that power spectrum is sensitive to cosmological parameters. I've shown here what happens if you change, say, the cosmological constant, leaving all the other cosmological parameters fixed. It turns out that just shifts the peaks over by some, it just rescales the x-axis or the l-axis of the plot by some constant multiplicative factor. If I varied the other cosmological parameters, I didn't show it in the plot, but that would produce a different characteristic pattern of offsets, suggesting that the cosmological parameters can be independently constrained, but perhaps with some large correlations. There may be accidental correlations between the shifts produced by the different parameters. So I'm going to talk about how you would forecast parameter sensitivity, assuming that the experiment hasn't been done yet. Sure.
If you change your omega lambda, are you holding everything else the same, or is this a different best bet for a different changed the
oh yeah, in this plot I changed all of the I left all of the physical parameters, all the parameters of the early universe fixed in like physical units. So I left the physical density of baryonic matter, the physical density of dark matter fixed at high redshift. If you're familiar with for people who are familiar with the cosmologist language, that amounts to fixing parameter combinations like omega b h squared rather than omega b.
I guess my question here is if you're changing omega lambda, if you've still got a flat universe, you're putting that energy density either in somewhere else or taking it from somewhere else, still have the lambda to one.
That's right. What I was trying to say is that I'm leaving the physical energy densities fixed at high redshift. At high redshift, when the CMB physics is happening, the cosmological constant is a negligible fraction of the total stress energy. I'm varying the cosmological constant in such a way that you wouldn't be able to tell the difference. An observer at high redshift that makes physical measurements, like measuring the physical densities, wouldn't be able to tell there was anything different. But today we can tell because we see a different cosmological constant. That's the direction in the parameter space.
It wouldn't change the curvature today because you kept the other densities fixed and changed this one. density of the dark energy, I guess.
If by curvature you mean four curvature, that's right. Yeah, yeah. I'm not.
Oh, I see, but you kept the three curvature, so you just adjust the time. You adjust the time level so that when the energy density is such and such, you still have a flat universe.
That's right. I'm not turning on spatial curvature, so the universe is still spatially flat. But of course, the four curvature changes since that's related to the stress energy.
So related to that, is that why the first peak didn't move?
Sorry?
And the first peak, all the other ones moved, but the first peak didn't move. Is it because of the things that you fixed?
It's because the... I was trying to get away with not explaining what was actually happening here, but let me just explain it. So all of the peaks are moving by the same fractional amount in L. So the shift is more larger at higher L, and it's not really visible in the first peak, but it's happening.
Oh, I see, but
the reason for that is that this direction and parameter space is actually really easy to think about. I leave all of the physics unchanged, but then when the CMB formation is happening. Then when I observe the CMB, I'm just observing that surface of last scattering from a different distance. The only thing that's changing is the expansion history after the CMB forms. And so you could imagine the pattern of fluctuations just frozen on the last scattering surface and asking what happens when you change the distance at which you observe the screen. And then all that happens under that rescaling is you leave the shape of the power spectrum unchanged because you're not changing the actual pattern of fluctuations. But you do change the correspondence between a physical distance on the screen and an angle by which you observe it. So that just rescales in L. It changes the correspondence between an angular wave number L and a physical wave number K by some rescaling. You could also think, another way of thinking about this is you can think of this, the CMB is giving you some scale here. And that's sort of like a standard ruler. There's some physical scale that's fixed on the surface of last scattering, and when I observe it, I'm measuring one parameter in the expansion history, the total distance between us and the screen. The example that I really want to think about is, or the example that I'll do in detail, is forecasting the parameter sensitivity of the CMB. It will be useful to think of an abstract setup. I'm going to draw pictures like this sometimes. Where I have some model parameters, some parameter space that I'm kind of trying to constrain, which could be the six parameters of the standard cosmological model, or I might add additional parameters, like say a neutrino mass, if I was interested in forecasting that. And then those parameters generate some data, which might be the CMB multiples, ALM, probabilistically. So the data are not a deterministic function of the model parameters data, but there's some probability distribution that generates them that depends on theta. This notation, P of D bar theta, is read as that's the conditional probability of the data D given values for the thetas. That's here in the slide. In this abstract setup, you might be interested if you're a data person in several different things. For example, the simulation problem is given some parameters theta. How would you simulate a random realization of the data D? And for the CMB, we talked about that last time. What you would do is you would simulate the CMB in harmonic space. That is, you would simulate the ALMs. And the advantage of doing it that way is that they're uncorrelated, so you don't need to keep track of a covariance matrix, or the covariance matrix is diagonal. You just simulate each ALM as a Gaussian random number whose variance is CL. There's a step that I missed in that explanation, which is how you go from the cosmological parameters to the CLs. And for purposes of this lecture, let's just say that the answer to that is that you just have a black box code that you run. You run a CAMB or class where you specify the cosmological parameters and it gives you the CLs. So you can think of the CLs as sort of being like some big special function that you compute. Just numerical.
Quick confirmation question. I meant to ask this yesterday. When you say Gaussian random variable, you mean it's like you've got a random number generator that's like has a Gaussian probability of picking something.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, that's right. If you've done an experiment, you might be interested in data analysis. This is sort of the opposite situation where you have some data and you don't know the model parameters. And you want to figure out what volume in the parameter space is allowed by the data, consistent with the data. Finally, there's forecasting, which is a situation that describes a situation where you haven't done the experiment yet, But you do know the probability distribution, the conditional probability distribution, P of D given theta. So I have some specification for when the experiment is done, how it will depend on the model parameters. And I want to understand what type of constraints or what allowed volume I might get in the model parameter space if given a typical realization of the data. And it turns out that that answer can depend on a rough fiducial guess for where you are in the model parameter space. So the forecasting machinery will involve a preferred choice of model, some preferred point in the model space. Usually the dependence is not very strong, but in principle, the constraints will depend on a preferred or fiducial set of values for the model parameters, but do not require a preferred realization of the data. And the Fisher matrix is a tool for forecasting that we use all the time in cosmology. Like if you're planning an experiment, you would want to forecast how well you'll do on cosmological parameters. Or you might be optimizing an experiment, trying to figure out, you know, if I have X amount of money to spend and I want to trade angular resolution, say telescope size, for sensitivity, number of detectors, then I can plot constraints on cosmological parameters as a function of that trade-off and optimize. If you're a theorist and you come up with some interesting new model to search for, you propose some new physics, then maybe you'd want to do some data analysis. But doing a full-blown data analysis is often like a really large amount of work. So you might want to do some quick forecast up front just to predict in advance whether you can, what kind of constraints you might get. So in this generality, I want to define what the Fisher matrix is and then talk about how to interpret it and its properties. So the Fisher matrix is the following matrix defined on the model space. I take the log of the probability distribution, and then I take its matrix of second derivatives, its Hessian matrix. That will be a function, because P of D given theta is a function of both D and theta, then when I take its Hessian matrix with respect to the model parameters, that's also a function of D and theta. And then I'll just take the expectation value over realizations of the data, add a fixed choice of fiducial model or a fixed set of model parameters. And that expectation value is now a matrix. I guess it's still a function of theta. It depends on the choice of fiducial model. That's the definition.
What does it mean, evaluated D, if you've got already P of D?
I'm sorry?
At the bottom right-hand corner, you've got D. And normally when you have that kind of thing, it means evaluated.
Oh, yeah. I didn't define that notation. So with the angle brackets, it means expectation value over. This is an expectation value over D. The interpretation is that this matrix is... I'll try to motivate this definition later. For now, let me just say that the interpretation is that the Fisher matrix F is the forecasted inverse covariance matrix of the model constraints that you expect to get for a typical realization of the data. I'll often represent in plots a covariance matrix as an ellipse. And the way that I draw this ellipse, given a covariance matrix, is that I start by writing down the Gaussian probability, the Gaussian PDF, for a random variable with a corresponding covariance matrix. And then I'm just thresholding that PDF at some value. Usually the threshold value is chosen so that the ellipse will enclose either 68% or 95% of the volume, or of the total probability. The Gaussian PDF has the property that its level contours are always ellipses. So in this figure, the extent of the ellipse, as we talked about last time, along the axes, is given by the corresponding diagonal element of the inverse covariance matrix. As a detail that is good to mention, but I forgot to include in the plot. This distance, the total x extent of the ellipse, with the other parameter floating, is a diagonal element of the. Let me just draw this on the board. here's some Gaussian random variable trivia that's sometimes useful. So if I have a Gaussian random variable with some covariance matrix, then this distance is the statistical error on parameter two, on parameter one, with parameter two marginalized or floating. And that is given by taking the diagonal element of the covariance matrix, which is the same thing as the diagonal element of the inverse Fisher matrix. And then there's also this distance, which is the statistical error that you would get on parameter one if parameter two was held fixed or you knew its value in advance. And that's equal to the, oh, sorry, I need it to have a square root here.
Root.
This guy for the. And that's equal to either 1 over the square root of the diagonal of the Fisher matrix, or another way to write this is 1 over the square root of the matrix element of the inverse covariance matrix. So these, of course, are not the same thing. 1 over the square root of the diagonal of F is not the same thing as the square root of the diagonal of the inverse matrix. And of course, the two correspond to either fixing those two notions of statistical error on parameter 1 correspond to either fixing or marginalizing parameter 2.
Question?
What
does it mean for a realization to be typical? And how do you know if yours is?
Oh, right, yeah, let me just, that's a good question. Let me just leave that defined informally for now, and then I'll try to come back and define it more formally later. One way of saying it is that if you, but here's the spirit of the definition. Imagine that I had many independent copies of the experiment. Then what would happen is that each of those copies might produce confidence region that might be different from this or non-elliptical because of a statistical fluctuation. But if I combine all of them, what I would eventually find is that things Gaussianize, and I start converging to an ellipse whose covariance is decreasing as 1 over the square root of the number of copies, whose size is decreasing as 1 over the square root of the number of copies. And that's what this ellipse represents. Is the prefactor of 1 over square root n in that like master ellipse. Okay, so the CMB is a little more complicated, but here's a toy example that just conveys the spirit of the forecasting machinery. So every statistics package has a button that you can press to do a linear regression, fit a best fit line through some points with error bars. Here's one. This is one Monte Carlo simulation, and I'm going to show the result of an experiment with many Monte Carlos in a minute. And the way that I made this plot is I started with some, the data here is really described by some true parameters, some, the blue line showed in the plot. And then I generated some data by adding Gaussian random numbers to the blue line. And just for fun, I made the error bars different sizes for the different points. Then if you press the button in the statistics package, it will fit a line through the points, the red line here. And that's not exactly the same as the blue line because there's some statistical noise, but it's consistent. This next plot shows the result of repeating this experiment many times with the blue parameters fixed and getting different red parameters in every Monte Carlo simulation. So the true simulation had some slope A and some intercept B. And when I do a bunch of simulations, I recover some parameters and they have some, there's some scatter that you can see in the plot. There's some extent along the two axes with some large covariance between the two parameters apparent in the plot. What I want to do is use the Fisher matrix formalism that I defined abstractly a few slides ago to forecast the result of doing this Monte Carlo experiment, just doing a short calculation and not actually needing to do the Monte Carlos. The way that in this example, the model parameters are the slope and intercept of the fit, A and B, And the data is the set of y values obtained here. As sort of a detail that does sort of matter when you're doing the Fisher matrix, when I do this Monte Carlo simulation, I'm fixing the x values and their statistical errors, and I'm randomizing the y's.
The covariance with which you randomize each y is a model parameter as well, right?
I'm leaving that fixed as well. I'm leaving the I pre-generate these error bars,
right,
and I leave them fixed.
You consider that as a model as part of your data, wouldn't you?
You could if you wanted to forecast how well you could constrain it. In this example, I wasn't doing that. I was just assuming that was known. I'm just forecasting the errors that I get on A and B. I could have decided to do it differently and include that as a parameter that I'm trying to estimate from the data. So first, in order to run the Fisher matrix formalism, first I need to write down this conditional probability, the probability of getting a certain realization of the data given some model parameters. To write that down, let me first write the probability distribution for a single y value given model parameters data. So the way these simulations work, I generate each y value by just starting at the blue line and adding a Gaussian random number. So the probability distribution for y is a Gaussian. We wrote down the Gaussian PDF last time. Which is centered at the location of the blue line with variance sigma, which is known in advance as part of the specification of the problem. It's convenient to use a little two-component vector notation since I'm representing the parameters A and B by a pair theta 1, theta 2. Let me just introduce this pair of functions, x and 1, so that the combination AX plus B is theta AFA. By the way, this does mean that the forecast that we'll do would apply to an arbitrary linear fit, like a polynomial fit, more than two components. So that's the conditional PDF of a single y value given true parameters, true model parameters, theta equals a comma b. And to compute the Fisher matrix, I need the conditional PDF of the entire data set. And since the y's are independent, I just get that by multiplying together the probabilities of each y. So if I start with this expression for the probability distribution of the y's, d here is a synonym for yi, the probability distribution of the y's given the thetas, then I can just compute this matrix. And that's a straightforward calculation. I've started with this formula for the probability distribution. I've plugged in here in the next line. The second line here. I've just taken the log of that PDF. In the third line, I'm trying to talk through this calculation since working from slides has both the advantage and the disadvantage that you can go through material really quickly. Whereas the blackboard like slows you down and makes you explain what you're doing. So in this step, I just did a little simplification where I noticed that if I'm going to take the second derivative of this expression on the second line, then I can drop terms that are either independent of theta or only contain one power of theta, and just keep this term that contains two powers of the thetas. When I take the derivative here, I've canceled some minus signs. And when I've taken the derivative, I pick up a factor of two that cancels here because there's two ways to pair the partial derivatives with the two thetas. I get this simple expression for the Fisher matrix that's easy to compute. It tells me that I just sum over the data values xi and the statistical errors enter, and in the end I get some 2x2 matrix. One thing that happens in this example is the step. Usually there's a step where you take the data, an expectation value over realizations of the data, or in this case, the y's. But in this example, it just happens that after you take the second derivatives, the y dependence drops out and there's no this expectation value is trivial. That won't happen in the CMB example. Another thing that's true here is that the Fisher matrix in the end turned out not to depend on the choice of fiducial model parameters, that is the parameters of the blue line in the plot. But usually there will be some, hopefully, small dependence on the fiducial model.
In this example, you've only got one type of data, y. Like, all of the points are the same measurement. They're all this distance, one distance. In most models, you have a bunch of different data of different types. How do you do this once per thing, or does the Fisher model matrix normally include all of those in a single one?
Oh, yeah. No, it's we do forecasts where you might be trying to find the joint constraints of a, say, I want to constrain cosmological parameters using a combination of the CMB plus some low redshift supernova measurements to constrain the expansion history. So the data D could stand for, could represent a data set that's formed by combining a bunch of different types of data. Now that combination, you know, if the data sets are independent, then it will turn out that the Fisher matrices just add. You can do the forecast separately and add the Fisher matrices in the end. But that's not always the case. If the data sets are correlated somehow, or maybe correlated in some subtle way, like they might share nuisance parameters. Okay, so in this example, if I compute this matrix and convert that, so the Fisher matrix is supposed to be an inverse covariance matrix. So if I invert it and plot the level contours of the corresponding multivariate Gaussian, then it explains this pattern of X's without actually having to do the Monte Carlo experiment. Now, in this toy example, there's no reason not to just do the Monte Carlo experiment. But in a more complicated example, like a CMB forecast, doing a Monte Carlo experiment where you do many repeated analyses of a full CMB data set might be really computationally expensive. Whereas the Fisher matrix is usually very easy to compute, and most of the calculation can be done analytically. Yes?
So in order to be able to apply the Fisher matrix formula over there, which comes from the expansion of the log into the Hessian part of it, you have to be able to do the Taylor expansion, right? So you have to be able to be in the likelihood space as, like, you know, you're close to likelihood space. But I wonder, how do you know a priori that your fiducial model, that your values that you're putting into the Fisher analysis are close to the maximum of the likelihood?
Oh, that's true. Yeah, you do need to. It is a feature of this forecasting formalism that you need to have a rough idea of where you are in parameter space. The forecast will depend on the choice of fiducial model. Usually this gets like swept under the rug a little bit because the dependence is usually sort of weak. I actually can't think of a good like real world cosmology example where the dependence is very important. Like if you chose to do a cosmology Fisher forecast, you need to choose fiducial values for all the cosmological parameters. But as long as you make one reasonable choice, the forecasts are unlikely to be different than if you make another reasonable choice. Like if I use the WMAP best fit cosmology or the Planck best fit cosmology.
But
in principle, it does depend.
Don't you need to run a Monte Carlo simulation to motivate your choice first? Like you first run a simplified simulation somehow to, like, you know, show that your procedures are Gaussian in the area that you're...
Oh, yeah. So you may be wondering how, in a complicated example, how do I know the probability distribution P of D given theta? In this example, by assumption, it had this Gaussian form. And there are analogous examples in cosmology, like the CMB. We think the CMB is a Gaussian random field, and we know how to compute its CLs from cosmological parameters. So we can write down the exact, as far as anyone knows, likelihood function for the CMB. By the way, I use the terms PDF and likelihood interchangeably, but I think that if you're a real statistician, there's supposed to be some nuanced difference between the two that I've never actually understood. Anyway, so I sometimes say likelihood instead of PDF. There's a bunch. You guys are asking very savvy questions because you're picking up on all the little hidden aspects of this. So let me try to take the issues one at a time. There's the choice of fiducial model, which is usually not very important in practice. That's the best answer I can give. There's also the issue of how do you know this PDF, P of D given theta? In some situations, you might have a really well-motivated PDF, like the CMB. But in other situations, it might require maybe that PDF is only accessible through expensive simulation? Like if I want to, if I'm dealing with a galaxy survey that has a bunch of astrophysical messiness in it, and I need to run a full in-body simulation to simulate the data, then modeling this PDF might be difficult. And that is an issue. It's part of the reason why this formulas, why forecasts can be difficult and a lot of work in practice, is that you have to model things and prove that your models are correct. Another issue may be, so you mentioned the word priors. You also might be interested in doing a forecast where, in addition to the data constraining the model space, you have some priors that you want to impose, like just sort of reasonableness regions on astrophysical parameters that aren't constrained well by the data. I think that's what you meant.
When you said that you use likelihood and PDF interchangeably, that's the difference, right? Likelihood and PDF, right? You have to have a posterior, right? To get a PDF, you have a posterior. And to get a posterior, you have to have the priors for the likelihood.
Sometimes statisticians do say posterior likelihood for the product, you know.
Right. The probability of the data given the theory, so that this part doesn't have the.
Yeah, yeah, if you're familiar.
This is close to the likelihood. I mean, it doesn't. This doesn't involve the priors, right?
Exactly, yeah, yeah. That's right.
Calculating the probability of theta given the D.
That's right, that's right. So if you're familiar with Bayesian statistics, there's also a posterior likelihood or a posterior PDF. This forecasting formalism doesn't, in Bayesian statistics, there's a posterior and there's also a prior. And unless you put them in by hand, this forecasting formalism does not involve priors or posteriors. You just need to know the conditional PDF, the forward PDF of the data given a set of models.
I guess you have to have some density because that's a probability density on the thetas. You have to have some prior measure on the thetas. You know, I mean, do you say that before you put this on, do you say it's uniform in some parameter or in the square of it or something?
For data analysis, for Bayesian data analysis, you do need to choose a prior. But for this forecasting
So if you had a region this is a density for the data, right? So densities you can change by just rescaling your thing. I mean, in other words, if you double the data, then your density would go down by a factor of two. So suppose you change the way you scale the data at different parts. So in other words, if your data was temperature versus temperature to the fourth, for example, then of course what's uniform and uniform probability with respect to temperature is not the same as uniform probability with respect to temperature to the fourth. So you're assuming something, some background on the data, some uniform distribution over the data, with respect to which the actual probability is some density times that.
That is not actually required for this to work. It's not obvious, but. It's not obvious from the way that it's written here, but this matrix is invariant under reparameterizations of the data.
Oh, I see. As long scales out because of that. Okay, so the metric on there probably rescales out from the derivatives or something.
That's right. That's right. It is generally an issue in data analysis that you need to choose priors, and priors are important. And this Fisher matrix formalism is kind of an exception in that it doesn't depend on. Except you have to choose a preferred model, which is sort of like a prior.
The log transform, if you reparameterize the thetas, then the log transforms the same way as the derivatives or something to cancel. Is that what happens?
That's right. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Okay. That's right.
That's over. Well, by definition, because the definition of it comes from the expansion of the likelihood only. If you expand the likelihood altogether, not the priors and the likelihood. So that's why they don't come in there.
You just don't need, everything here is phrased in terms of like conditional forward likelihood. And you just don't need a prior on the model space.
All right, so by preferred model, you mean in this case that we assume it's a line, right? In this model case.
So that would, not only that it's a line, but that you are doing the forecast, assuming that the true model is close to some fixed set of parameters. Like in this example, I chose a equals 1.2, and I forgot what the intercept is. In general, the Fisher matrix will depend on that choice of the Fiducial model. You know, so for cosmological parameters, this issue usually gets swept under the rug in cosmology because there's usually more or less a natural choice of cosmological model, which is you use the best fit cosmological parameters from, say, Planck. And then if you're interested in some interesting extension of the standard model, like allowing the dark energy to not be a cosmological constant, then you just make its fiducial value the most boring value, which is that the time dependence is of the energy density is zero. Okay. And here's a cosmological example. I took this from sort of an arbitrarily chosen forecasting paper on the archive where this type of Monte Carlo experiment was done for a real cosmological data set. Now, this happens to be a supernova example, not a CMB experiment. So here the ellipses show the result of doing the Fisher matrix forecast. And that would be a really short, like, pencil and paper calculation. And these points represent the result of doing a very expensive Monte Carlo simulation where you simulate many copies of the experiment like I did for the linear regression case. And so in this example, the Fisher matrix is working well at predicting the result of the simulation. Although the Fisher matrix is an approximation where you approximate the true scatter plot, which may have some complicated shape, which is not perfectly an ellipse, you're making some sort of Gaussian approximation where level contours are ellipses. But the Fisher matrix usually, not always, and it's hard to give a general criterion for when it works and when it doesn't, which is an issue, but it usually works. The Fisher matrix formalism in this case is doing a good job of forecasting the statistical errors in their covariance. If you're interested in predicting the constraints at say the tens of percent level, then it's a very quick process that works well.
If you had seen just the Monte Carlo simulation without the contours drawn on it, like, would you have said, okay, I mean, a Gaussian approximation is okay in this case, I'm gonna go ahead and use my Fisher matrix prediction capabilities to full potential? Like, you would have been satisfied with what you have over there and be like, even though it's a banana kind of thing, I'm gonna be like, it's Gaussian enough.
That's true, yeah, exactly.
Any way to... Like, when you yourself as a researcher, do you have a scale which you decide when, like, okay, I'm going to use it now and not now? Like, you know, is it banana enough or not banana enough?
I think in practice, the way it usually works is that the forecast can tell you. So if all parameters are well constrained, then it usually works very well. And the case where it doesn't work well is when you have, you could imagine that this is sort of an intermediate case where the parameters are constrained, like, okay. But if I had some, degeneracy in the model space, so I had some, complicated-looking banana, then what the Fisher matrix would do is it would be telling me sort of local information. It would be like picking out the tangent direction to the banana. Globally, it wouldn't be a good match. But if there are no, large degeneracies, if everything's well-constrained, then this is not an issue. And if there is a degeneracy, then the Fisher matrix will tell you that the degeneracy exists. So you will see from the Fisher matrix that there is a poorly constrained direction with large statistical errors. But it won't really tell you much about the global structure of the parameter space. But that's usually good enough for forecasting and optimizing experiments. So. So those are actually all the slides that I have. And I'm going to switch to Blackboard for the rest of the lecture. For the first few, slides, for the first few Blackboards, I'm going to talk about how to compute a Fisher matrix for a real CMB forecast. So let me just start by writing some things down that I talked about last time. So the CMB is a two-dimensional spherical random field. meaning that it would be represented in real space by a function of theta and phi, and in harmonic space by a sequence of spherical harmonic coefficients ALM. The two-point function or covariance is easy to write down in complicated in position space, but diagonal in harmonic space. Where this equation defines the power spectrum CL. Something I forgot to mention last time, but will be important when we do detailed calculations, is that the spherical harmonics are complex functions of theta and phi, but they satisfy an identity that the negative m's are the complex conjugates of the positive m's with a sine of minus 1 to the m. And it follows that if t is a real quantity, and I take the complex conjugate of both sides here, that the negative ALMs are related to the positive ALMs by the same formula. So if I just want to count modes, then for each multipole L, there are 2L plus 1 real coefficients in the harmonic expansion. There's AL0, which is real. If M is 0, then this identity says that ALM is real. And there's the real and imaginary parts of AL1, dot, 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 and then the real and imaginary parts of AL. And those 2L plus 1 real numbers have the following 2L plus 1 by 2L plus 1 covariance matrix. So I just wanted to write this down so that I could explain the factors of 2. The expectation value of ALM times ALM star is CL, and that's split between half and half between the real part and the imaginary part.
I'm sorry, I can't read the first word. It looks like wide.
Oh, yes. Width.
Width, okay.
The CMB is a Gaussian random field, which means that if you want to simulate it or write down its likelihood function, then all the information that you need is contained in the previous statements. The two-point function or the covariance matrix completely determines the statistics.
Left-hand element different from all of the other diagonal ones?
Oh, yeah, so the expectation value of ALM, ALM star, is CL. And so for AL0, which is real, I get variance CL. But for the higher M's, for example, M equals 1, then it's split half and half between the variance of the real part and the variance of the imaginary. These are the sort of little details that just don't get mentioned when flashing through slides, but are important when we do calculation. Here's a fun fact about the CMB. So the CMB is a Gaussian random field, and that's something that is just really easy to see in a simple way if you're given a CMB map. If you download like the Planck maps and do something really simple, like say you just make a histogram of all the temperature values in every pixel of the map. Then the Gaussian, you'll get a perfectly Gaussian distribution to something like 0.1% statistical error. So the Gaussianness is sort of staring us in the face in C and B. Or as another example, let's say that I take all pairs of points in the CMB sky that are separated by some fixed separation, like 5 degrees. Then if I plot the 2D histogram of the temperature in pixel 1 and the temperature in pixel 2, I'll get a two-variable Gaussian PDF with some covariance that I could compute if I computed the correlation function of the CMB. As you would expect for a Gaussian random variable, if the CMB is a big multivariate Gaussian random variable, then whenever I do any sort of linear projection down to, say, 1 or 2 degrees of freedom, I expect the Gaussianness to be preserved. Now, if we didn't have any theory, and this was all we knew about the CMB, that it was some sort of Gaussian random variable, then I think your first guess would be to assume that the central limit theorem is the underlying source of that randomness. That's usually where Gaussian random numbers come from. Like if we take the all of the air molecules in this room, then the x, y, and z components of their velocities are Gaussian random, because they're built up from the independent sum of a bunch of collisions, and the central limit theorem is Gaussianizing them. But the reason that the CMB is Gaussian, at least according to our current theory, is true for a different reason that traces back to the fact that the ground state of a harmonic oscillator has a Gaussian functional form. In Schrodinger equation quantum mechanics, you know, the ground state of a harmonic oscillator looks like this. I'm probably getting the, I think this is over 4, so I'm probably getting the factors wrong. As far as I can tell, it's just kind of a coincidence that the ground state of a harmonic oscillator has the same functional form as the Gaussian PDF that comes out of proving the central limit theorem. Those two. The reason that this has functional form e to the minus x squared has nothing to do with the central limit theorem, I think. This is just sort of an interesting coincidence. Okay.
I suppose, strictly speaking, temperature couldn't be precisely Gaussian because presumably there probably is zero for it to be negative. But that's probably extremely tiny probability that the tail, let's say it's so far from the mean. Probably ignore the tail.
Oh, yeah, that is true, right. Yeah, I agree. I mean, it would be like a 100,000 sigma fluctuation. but as a point of principle, I agree that that implies that it cannot be strictly guessed.
Do you have negative temperatures for dark energy?
Negative temperature means, as I understand it, means statistical mechanics means you have some sort of situation where the ground state is less populated than states with higher energy. I'm not aware of any dark energy context where that could happen. But there's one thing I've learned from doing physics. It's that theorists are infinitely creative in coming up with weird examples. So don't quote me on that. Okay. So let's start by asking this question. How well can CL be measured? If all ALMs have been observed with zero noise, this will be the so-called cosmic variance limit. So I'm going to do a forecast with one model parameter. CL for a specific value of L. And the data will be 2L plus 1 real numbers. So I need to start by writing down the conditional probability of getting a given set of 2L plus 1 ALMs given a model CL. And I can put together that probability distribution from looking at this covariance matrix. So there's a term with, so M equals 0 is, has an extra factor of 2 relative to the higher m's. So this is just the usual Gaussian PDF for a Gaussian random variable AL0 with variance CL. And then for the higher m's, we have a Gaussian random PDF with variance CL over 2 for the real part, and another, and then the same factor for the imaginary part. There's some factors of 2 here that are different from the L equals 0 term. Now, if you stare at this, a nice way of writing it is I'll pull out an overall constant, which is all these factors of pi and 2 pi, and then write CL, the 2L plus 1 over 2, times the product over all m from minus L to L. So this is just a convenient way to write it that doesn't distinguish between m equals 0 and m greater than 0. What's happening here is that for the higher m's, so I've combined the square of the real part and the square of the imaginary part into the total absolute square. And what's happening in this product is that for m not equal to 0, the negative m and the positive m factor are combining to cancel off this factor of 2. This just happens to work algebraically.
I might just not have heard you, but how did you get the
extent
of
2L
plus
1
over
2?
And it looks like it should be CL to the 3 halves. Oh, no,
because
it
doesn't product it out. Okay. Exactly. Now we'll compute the Fisher matrix, which is a 1 by 1 matrix. Put matrix in quotes. There's only one model parameter. F is going to be... So, I've written CL here instead of theta, and taken the expectation value. I've written it as an expectation value over ALM instead of. Yes.
Okay. Just wanted to make sure. Well, sometimes it's unclear if you're taking
it
with respect to CL squared.
Oh yeah, maybe I should write this. Hold on. Okay. And this is a straightforward calculation by plugging in the functional form of the PDF above. In this step, I've taken the log and dropped the overall constant. I'll go through it because there's it's a little different from the calculation, the example that I did on the slides. So in this step, I took the log of the PDF and I dropped the constant, but I didn't take the derivative yet. In this step, I'll take the derivative. And then, unlike the example that I did on the slides, in this example, the expectation value over the ALMs is non-trivial. What I need to do is take the expectation value of ALM squared, but that's equal to CL. So in the next step, what's going to happen is I'll take the expectation value, this ALM squared will become CL, And then since the quantity being sum doesn't depend on m anymore, I can just replace it by a factor of 2l plus 1.
Oops, no angle bracket.
And so the final result is 2l plus 1 over 2 times 1 over cl squared. And the interpretation of this, remember, I'm about to erase the picture that I was needed to talk about. The interpretation of the Fisher matrix is that it's the forecasted inverse covariance matrix of the parameter constraints. So the statistical error, here there's only one parameter that I'm assigning and forecasting an error bar for. So its statistical error is the square root of its variance, which is 1 over the square root of the corresponding 1 by 1 Fisher matrix. And so what I found here is that the statistical error on CL is 2 over square root of 2L to plus 1 times CL. Another thing that happens in this example is that the Fisher matrix depends on the fiducial CL. All that means is that the statistical error on CL ends up being proportional to CL itself. In other words, it's a fixed fractional error. So this is the so-called cosmic variance error, which is the best error bar you can ever put on the CMB power spectrum. If all modes are measured on the whole sky with no noise. If you look at the error bars from WMAP or Planck, which measure almost the whole sky, about 70% of it, then they follow this form. Every L is measured, and the error bars at low L are large, and then they decay as 1 over root L. What happens if you go out far enough is that they start to, so the error bars are really tiny at, say, L of 1,000 in Planck. Each L is measured to, a few percent, because that's what you get from the formula. So the total statistical power of all the statistical measurement of all the L's is really fantastic. When you get to high L, the error bars start to blow up again and are no longer given by cosmic variance, because instrumental noise has become important. The reason that there's cosmic variance, the reason that you can't reduce these error bars to zero, is that there are just a finite number of modes on the sky that you can never measure in our Hubble volume. For example, this huge error bar on the quadrupole exists because there are only 5 modes, and those are, if I only have 5 samples, independent samples from a Gaussian random variable, and I'm trying to estimate its width or the its variance or the width of the distribution, then I'm just forced to assign a huge error bar. And cosmology is sort of unique in that cosmic variance is a problem. It's definitely an annoying problem. And the CMB power spectrum is full of little, 2-ish, maybe 2.5 sigma anomalies that can never go away because they're cosmic variance limited. For example, one thing about the CMB power spectrum that has attracted a great deal of curiosity is that the quadrupole happens to be low at around 2 sigma. And the octupole, the L equals 3 mode, now would be a good time to mention that L equals 2 is the lowest multipole in the CMB power spectrum, because L equals 0, the monopole, is the 2.7 Kelvin background, which we usually subtract off and don't consider part of the power spectrum. The dipole, in principle, the last scattering surface has a dipole on it, but the Doppler motion of the Earth relative to the last scattering surface adds an independent dipole which can't be separated from the so-called primordial dipole. And so, L equals 1, you can think, and it's huge. On this plot, it would be like off the scale. So the L equals 1 mode is just sort of like a cosmic speedometer that's measuring our motion relative to the surface of last scattering, or the average velocity of the universe. And L equals 2 and up is like cosmological anisotropy. Oh yeah, so there's you know, a bunch of curious features at low L, like the quadrupole is low at 2 sigma and the octopole is low at 1 sigma. It could be that this is just a statistical fluke that, you know, if we imagine our universe filled with observers that each live in their own independent Hubble volume, and they're each doing their own CMB experiments, that we're one of the 5% that are scratching our heads about why the quadrupole happens to look so low, and it's just a coincidence. Or it could be because, you know, L equals 2 is such a special number that it has some deeper significance. But I don't think there's really, in the absence of any additional evidence, it's impossible to ever reach a conclusion on that. There's also like a dip at, and there's actually a whole literature. There are probably 100 papers that are finding weirdness in the CMB at cosmic variance limited scales and speculating on it. For example, if you just plot the quadrupole pattern of our CMB on the sky, if you take the CMB map and only keep the L equals 2 modes, and then you do the same for the octopole pattern, they look lined up with each other with a statistical significance of like 1%. It's like 1% unlikely. But there's no real model that predicts that, so it's hard to draw any conclusion. It's probably just a statistical fluke, since there are so many. Once you start thinking about just totally arbitrarily constructed statistics like quadrupole octopole alignment, there's probably lots of other weird arbitrarily constructed statistics that you could look for, like maybe order 100, and it's probably just a statistical fluke. One source of low L weirdness that I'll mention because it actually affects parameter constraints is that it just happens that there's a big dip in power at L of around 20. A bunch of multipoles in a row are low at around 1 sigma. And this has a total statistical significance of around 2.5 sigma, or it's about 1% unlikely. And what's interesting about this is that if there are gravity waves, then the way they show up in the temperature power spectrum is that they produce an excess of power on the scales. And this has the interesting consequence that the temperature constraints, like the Planck constraints on primordial gravity waves, are a lot stronger than the forecast would suggest. One way to think about it is that the data formerly prefer a negative gravity wave power spectrum, which makes no physical sense. And that makes it really unlikely, even adding a small amount of, you know, if the data are formerly preferring negative gravity waves at 2.5 sigma, then adding even a little bit of gravity waves, what would normally be a 1 sigma shift, now decreases the probability to 3.5 sigma, which is like incredibly unlikely. So if you interpret this dip as a statistical fluke, then it's correct to say that the Planck constraints on gravity waves are like a factor of 2 or 3 better than the Fisher matrix forecast would suggest. If there were more to the story, if this were like some sort of foreground artifact, for example, which I think is I think it's probably just a statistical fluke, then you would need to revise that measurement by assigning a large systematic error, for example. So this cosmic problem of cosmic variance is sort of unique to cosmology. In particle physics, we would never be talking about these 2 or 3 sigma effects because we could just take a wait and see attitude. If a 3 sigma anomaly shows up in a collider, then we can just run the collider for longer and it'll either go up to 5 sigma or it'll go away. But we can't do that in cosmology because we've already observed the entire universe and there's only one universe to measure. So that is sort of a cultural difference, is that cosmologists just spend a lot more mental energy thinking about 2 and 3 sigma effects. A version of this formula that I'll write down, but I won't really derive, is that if I want to go beyond the cosmic variance limit by accounting for instrumental noise and finite sky coverage, then this is a version that's sometimes used where F sky is the fraction of sky observed. Which might be like 70.7 for a satellite experiment. And NL is the noise power spectrum. If I model the instrumental noise as an uncorrelated source of temperature fluctuations or apparent temperature fluctuations with some power spectrum NL. And what that would look like for a realistic experiment is that it would start out very tiny, and then at some point it would start to blow up. And in Planck, that happens at an L of around 1500. And that was a big improvement over the previous experiment, WMAP, which had worse angular resolution and started to become noise dominated at L of around 500. Okay. Now, every time I lecture, I rediscover this time dilation effect where I actually thought that getting to this point in the notes would take about 20 minutes. let me start streamlining the derivations a little bit. Since the fun part of the talk, what I thought would be fun to tell you guys about is how you can sort of think of this Fisher matrix as like a geometric object. A forecast that you would want to do if you were a professional Fisher matrixologist is one where I have some cosmological parameters, maybe 6 parameters. And then my data consists of the entire CMB sky, all of the CMB multipoles, maybe with some partial sky coverage and instrumental noise included. Let me just, instead of going through every line of the algebra, let me just sort of write down the beginning and the end. So to do this forecast, you would start with by writing down the conditional likelihood of the data given the model, which is just given by, if I go back to this this intermediate result in the previous calculation that gives the likelihood of a given, the multipoles at a given L conditioned on an assumed value of the power spectrum CL, then in this case, I would just write down one copy of that likelihood function for each ALM, for each value of L. And this is a function of the cosmological parameters theta, because CL is a function of theta. So you can compute numerically. And now if I compute the Fisher matrix, and the CMB is really nice because I can write down an exact likelihood function. And I don't really have to do any modeling, besides assuming that I have some software package that can take me from the thetas to the CLs. Let me switch these. Well, I'll leave that one up, so I'll come over here. Is there an eraser? I don't actually.
I believe that they're all called upper.
Oh, yeah, yeah, okay. My fault.
There's this the strings.
Oh, okay, okay. I'm gradually learning this high-tech kind of technology. Okay. So that calculation is a few lines of algebra, which are very, very similar to the previous calculation. And that's a good exercise if you want to try it. And this is the answer that you get. Turns out that the Fisher matrix depends on the fiducial power spectrum CL and its derivative, its first derivatives with respect to the parameters. There are second derivative terms, terms involving the second derivative of CL with respect to parameters, but they turn out to cancel in the calculation. Okay, and so let me also say that in the presence of forecast would give you cosmic variance limited errors on cosmological parameters, and for a real experiment you would use a version that had a sky fraction and a noise power spectrum, which turn out to go here. In this version, in the cosmic variance limited version of the formula, I've assumed that you've measured all of the ALMs up to some maximum multipole. And here I haven't put an upper limit on the sum because what would happen for a real experiment is that the noise power spectrum would blow up at high L and the sum would convert.
Why did the
M's
drop out?
More or less for the same reason as in the previous calculation. Unfortunately, I erased the ending of it, but in the last calculation, when I took the expectation value over the ALMs, then that replaced the expectation value of ALM squared by CL and removed it.
You had a part interval of M going from negative L to L there. And you've now only got a single summation from L equals 2 to L max. Why isn't there a second summation for the exponential?
You could say that it happens for the same reason. So I didn't do the algebra, but if you do the algebra, it happens for the same reason as in this calculation. In this calculation, P was a product over M. But in the final answer, there was no sum over M. Or rather, it was replaced by this factor of 2L plus 1. All right. So if you wanted to compute this Fisher matrix, you can use the you can use standard software packages to compute CL from theta. So this is a black box CAM or class. And if you have a black box that computes CL from theta, then the way you would compute the first derivative that you need in the Fisher matrix is by just numerically differentiating the black box. You could run it with one of the, whatever cosmological parameter you want to differentiate with respect to, shifted by some amount. And then, just for pedanticness, I use a two-sided differencing scheme, which is more numerically stable than a one-sided scheme, to numerically estimate the power spectrum derivative. And this would tell you, once you've computed this matrix, it would tell you everything that you need to know about the ability of your experiment to constrain cosmological parameters. You would invert this matrix, and you could plot the whole ellipsoid in a six-parameter space, projected onto various axes if you wanted to forecast error bars on one cosmological parameter, forecast it over the other five, and so on. About halfway through the notes, but I only have 10 minutes left. So let me just... Well, I feel like it's better to stop here and pick up next time. I didn't actually get to the part of this that I think is fun. But I'll try to do it in sort of like first 20 minutes or so next time. Okay. Would anyone like to ask? So let's stop here for this lecture. Would anyone like to ask any questions? Yes.
Yes, we'd like to know what software you use to calculate the CLs.
So there's several software packages. There's something called CAMB that is really widely used. I think that all the cool kids are using something else called Class nowadays. I'm not sure.
What makes that cool? Why is it
better? It's not Fortran.
True. That's right. Yeah, if you have to modify, it's much easier to modify. I think that's the main
Remind me again. The reason that we have this map in the CLs in the end is because from theory we get the CLs, right?
Yes.
Because otherwise you could just compare it to the ALMs and then... If you can measure them without noise, then you wouldn't have to bother about cosmic variance.
I'm not sure that I follow that question, actually. The CLs... So the way this works is that, you know, the theory only predicts... the CLs deterministically. So CL is some... deterministic function of the thetas, which is computed by numerically integrating
it. That's what I was asking, yeah.
And then the last step is, so this is deterministic but complicated, and then the last step is probabilistic but simple.
Yeah.
I guess, yes. So I did the Fisher matrix formalism is really general and can be used in any situation where there's some parameters that you're trying to constrain and then some data that you measure. And I did the case of a power spectrum forecast where a hidden assumption was that the ALMs were Gaussian and the cosmological parameters, so that they are fully their statistics are fully described by the power spectrum. And that the only way that the cosmological parameters change the data, affect the data, is by modifying the power spectrum. Power spectrum forecasts, most data analyses in cosmology, I would say, are power spectrum analyses, but not all. And there are, as another example, you might be interested in non-Gaussianity, where you're interested in a situation where the power spectrum, say, is fixed. And you have some model parameter over here, a name like FNL, which is controlling the non-Gaussianness of this set of multipoles. Like it might be a coefficient in some complicated three-point function. And you can also do a Fisher matrix forecast. In this situation, you can write down an expression for the conditional PDF as a function of this model parameter FNL. It's a more complicated calculation. You would use something called the Edgeworth expansion to describe the effect of adding a three-point function, perturbing the Gaussian PDF by adding a three-point function. You can get a Fisher matrix, a more complicated Fisher matrix, that forecasts your ability to constrain this type of parameter. Those sorts of Fisher matrix forecasts for higher point correlation functions are done not as frequently as power spectrum analyses, but fairly frequently.
I'm not wondering if seems, write something like BA along BCL or similar when you're taking those derivatives. I feel like A along should, because it's clearly directly related to, and so when you're taking those derivatives, it should, there should be a derivative. Can you just like skip that algebraic step? Or for some reason why that can be considered not
variance. Oh, unfortunately, I erased the algebra of that calculation. But the, you know, in general, when you do this, let me just write the formula for the Fisher matrix. Let me just write it down in its general form, where D could be anything, possibly a set of ALMs. And theta could be anything like the power spectrum CL or some cosmological parameter that controls the CLs. Then, you know, as you do the calculation, when you start out, P is a function of both D and theta. And then when you take these derivatives in general, it's still a function of both D and theta. Then there's this step where you take the expectation value over d, where the d dependence drops out, and you just get, in the end, a function of the thetas.
Yeah. No, I believe that. I was just wondering if, because ALM is your data, you consider it to be not varying with the parameters. So, because like when you were doing, you were doing, you have a DCL d data, you never have a DALM d data. You never wrote that. I don't know if that was just a step you skipped. Or if we're considering theta to be formally invariant.
Well, yeah, this partial derivative means partial derivative with respect to theta at fixed D.
Okay.
All right, if there are no more questions, I'll see you tomorrow.